CliffCentral.com. Yes, good morning. If you've just woken up and you just started your day, it is Tuesday the 4th of May. May the 4th be with you.
Oh, no. Yes. I didn't even realize it was that day.
You missed that at the start of the show, Mbulelo. But Mbulelo's here, Sia's here, I'm here, and you're here, and that's all that matters today. Quickly, I had the most bizarre thought this morning. You know how you're lying in bed? I had every intention of waking up extra early this morning, hopping in the shower. There were a couple of things I wanted to do before I even started the show, but I hit that snooze button. Now, what is
danger?
No, I know it's stupid, right? But we don't need to go down that path. I thought of something.
Oh.
You know how when you're really, really thirsty, you would pay R100 for a drink? You know when you are when you're really exhausted at work and you haven't made supper, you'll pay whatever to get Mr. Delivery to bring you something to eat if you're still at the office and you need to get things done. I reckon you could get me to part with thousands of rands for an extra hour or two of sleep in the morning. Is there not an economy we can create for time where it would be possible for me to say, all right, I'm going to inconvenience a couple of thousand people this morning if I'm 2 hours late. What is that worth? If it's worth 5,000 rand, let's say, because it inconveniences each of those 5,000 people by one rand in terms of their actual inconvenience, right? They put a price to it. And I can then say, all right, I'm so tired. I just want to have an extra 2 hours of sleep. I then pay 5,000 rand, and that money goes to each of the people who I would have been, you know, I would have seen at the appointed time. But I get my extra 2 hours. I would be willing to do that some mornings.
I like what you're saying, but you are in a very unique position. Who gets to decide the value? Because I'm not comfortable with you deciding the value. Because if I'm a Gareth Cliff fan, which I am, and I really want to listen to you, you shouldn't get to decide how much you mean to me. Because we're in a relationship. I get to decide. So what if I say, all right, Gareth, to me, it's $250.
Nah,
yeah. Or is it not an open market?
No, but then suddenly,
because I like what you're saying.
All right. Well, then we've got to almost establish some kind of blockchain,
exactly.
decentralized ledger to figure this out. Because now everybody's going to be inputting what they think it's worth in any job. Let's not take me. I made it about me because it's easier for me to consider who I would be inconveniencing if I don't pitch up for work today. But I was lying in bed going, you know, if you really want something. At the moment you need it the most, you're prepared to pay whatever it costs to have that thing. And there are some mornings I wake up where I just go, you know what? I'd easily pay a couple of $100 just to have an extra hour of sleep today. There's got to be a way we can make that happen for people. There's got to be a time economy we can set up parallel to all the other economies where you just say to people, listen, I'm not going to be able to make that meeting today. Because they don't know, but you've paid money into the time economy and you can postpone the meeting for that reason. There's got to be a way we can do this. I feel like the greatest commodity we have is time, and we haven't yet found a way to make time equal to money. I mean, I know that that's, you know, the case for doctors and for lawyers, that they charge for their time. But I'm talking about your time that you aren't professionally charging for. There's got to be a way you can value that. And you can buy some of it back for yourself, for when you need to sleep in, for when you need a day, you know, for mental health. Maybe that's a thing, because everybody these days is talking about mental health. And we're thinking of starting something, by the way, which we'll get to on the mental health tip a little bit later on. But you might need a day for your relationship. Maybe you want to go away with your significant other, you know, take them away for a long weekend, and you need to buy your Friday back from the business, from other people. I think you should be able to.
I like this.
There's maybe we need to set up an economy where you can actually buy back some of your own time for whatever purpose you have for it. Nobody can ask questions because you've spent money buying that time. It's yours. Take that time in advance instead of money. So you could say to your boss, I'll tell you what, cut my salary to 3/4 of what it is and give me 1/4 of my time back. Now, that's real 21st century thinking. Don't you think? Like I'll work,
absolutely.
I'll work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, half of Thursday, but Thursday afternoon and Friday, the whole day is mine. And you could pay me a quarter less than you pay me right now. But that's what I would rather have the time than the money.
Have you seen the deep fakes that are going around on the internet? So the nerds have thought about what you're talking about.
I think. But I think
the nerd. What I'm saying is, the nerds are figuring what you're saying out. Is if you could imagine, you could get a deep fake Gareth Cliff now, a Gareth Cliff deep fake, and you're not really sitting here, and you've got the deep fake, and you know those that AI is incredible. That it would have at least 30,000 of your idiosyncrasies, and then so you're not even here. You're sleeping right now, and I feel like people know. People think you're Gareth. You're sitting in your at home, but it's actually a deep fake, and it is very Gareth. It's got all of this. It does make you. It does punch you in the brain a little bit, like punch you down. You're not quite as smart as I am. Just like you do brilliantly, subtly, Gareth.
You make me sound like a fucking tyrant, man.
I sound
horrible. Bulelo had to write my epitaph. No one would ever. That people would piss on my grave as they walked past.
Listen. you know what I'd do for you, because obviously in a COVID economy they charge per letter. I mean, have some respect. He lived, he was better than you, he died. Gareth Cliff.
See, that's horrible, because then it'll sound it'll sound like I said that, and then people will piss on the grave. Listen, I mean, I know you go around telling people that they're better or worse than each other, that you're judgmental like I am, but I'm careful not to throw myself into that equation, dude, because I don't really think that. There's some days I wake up and I'm like, what have you done in your life? Come on, we all like that. Everybody is.
You're not like that. And I was being a little sort of hyperbolic then, and I was just kidding. No, in fact, one thing that I have loved about working here is you're the opposite of that.
Why are we talking about
you?
You
are the opposite.
Let me ask you this. You've been following the news, and I know this is something we spoke about briefly last week, but this whole Somizi divorce that's going on, we spoke earlier about how you keep a marriage going, and, you know, we spoke about Bill Gates and Melinda Gates getting divorced, but Somizi and Mohale, the two of them are getting divorced. It's getting so ugly. I mean, there's so much stuff coming out now about, you know, the way their relationship went towards the end, and I don't know whether it's coming from the two of them or it's coming from insiders, you know, friends who are starting to talk to the media. Who knows? But this must be killing Somizi, because actually I know the guy, and he does not like this kind of gossip about him. So who does? Who likes this kind of gossip about themselves? I mean, there are people who thrive on it, like the Kardashians, I suppose. But really, I don't get the idea from the little bit I know about Somizi, and we worked together for 4 years or whatever. I don't think he likes any of this. This is not his vibe.
So why does he put the relationship out there? It's one thing I've never understood about people. The only reason I found out about the divorce because Simpiwe in the office, they're throwing stuff out there, you know, and we were talking about this. But for me, I've always wondered with couples, don't do that. It's like, you know, with my personality type, I'm never going to complain if people don't like me, because I know how I come off. I don't like the fact that couples go public, and then when things go wrong, oh, we expect our privacy. No. No. You don't take people on that ride, and then when things go wrong, now you all of a sudden you want to be the Catholic Church and do things behind closed doors. No, sir. I have no empathy for that.
Stay away from religion.
Yeah. Apologies. Religions have done good things. But for me, because
don't
I know
apologize
my business,
to us. Apologize to him.
Hare pra God. Sorry. Sorry, pra God. But like, if you're going to be my personality type, you better expect blowback. And, you know, you're going to walk around how I walk around. You should expect people to react a certain way. So I'm not going to complain if people don't like me. If you're going to put your relationship out there, do not complain when we want to know more. What happened? Hey, we knew it wasn't going to work. He's twice your age. Sorry. So Mizi doesn't get that empathy from me. I'm sorry. Otherwise, don't put it out.
Yeah. That's a tough one,
don't
man. That's a tough one. I don't know. Linda agrees with you. She says you can't have it both ways. So you don't get to declare things private after you've already let people in. Basically, is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I just,
what do you
it's
think?
Not the way it
Sia,
works.
Sia, what do you think about this? I mean, you've known Somizi and Mohale as well. We've both met them a number of times. You've brought them onto the show. We recorded an interview with them 2 years ago, which you can go and listen to. What do you think of this?
Mm-hmm. I see or hear of an official statement regarding their relationship, then we can decide. Because for now, yeah, it just looks a little too messy. You know, Somizi has unfollowed Mohale. Oh, I've heard whispers
around. If someone unfollows you,
that,
that's the worst. I mean, you know, divorce is nothing, but unfollowing, that's terrible.
Well, I mean, yeah, they don't really post about each other. They don't talk about each other much anymore, even in the public sphere. Mm. I've heard whispers that they can only confirm it after 2 years because that was a clause that they signed with Showmax. So up until, I heard Mohammed with of the female persuasion.
Hang on, you broke up there. You said you heard Mohale moved out.
Moved out and moved on with people of the female persuasion.
Pump the brakes there. I just like to jump in there. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to jump in there and see her as our ear on the ground. Rumor has it.
I am not the ear on the ground. Don't give me any of this.
Right. Too late, Sia. We've labeled you now. We're moving on. You're our source. I heard that, in fact, Mohale was taken from a female by Somizi as the great Jacob Gezehlegi Samsholo Zizuma said, in the beninging, Mohale was actually with a woman. Can you deny that, or can you confirm that, Mr. Sangweni, sir?
You know what's nice about my life? And, like, I try to explain this to people, but it never truly makes sense to a lot of people. It is so nice to be quarter to in the spotlight. No, we see so much behind the scenes and people come in for interviews. Yep. You see people shit. That's part of what I miss about doing a show in studio in the mornings with the interviews. People come in disheveled. People come in too early after they've just had a fight with their spouses. People come in hating their kids because they got stuck in traffic and that's why they're late. People come in and they hide divorces, pregnancies, you name it. But you know what? When I clock out, I come back home, I close the blinds,
nobody bothers the door.
And I get to live my own life. So that's all I'm going to say. Anyway, so you know who my couple goals are? Doug and Kamala. That's what I'll have to
All right,
say.
So let's go to Doug and Kamala Harris. This is the vice president of the United States and her husband, who we call the second husband or what? Second gentleman. What a ridiculous term.
I think his official term is not SCOTUS.
Oh, God, no. SGOTUS, Second Gentleman of the United States.
Second Gentleman of the United States. Yes, SCOTUS.
SCOTUS.
Oh, my God.
Good God. That is so humiliating. If I were him, I'd say, you know what, just call me Doug.
Speaking as a man, right? Can you imagine how demeaning second gentleman is? Sorry, I don't know how women think. I know as a man, if somebody called me the second gentleman, I mean, just don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining, man. Second gentleman.
This is why I raised up, because I know when you're talking about how people can be fake and let's just come off as nice. I believe to the core of my being that this was all part of a ploy. Doug and the vice president sat with their team and went, how do we become more relatable? What can we do? So here's a moment.
What have they done? Show me.
From the presidential address last week that we didn't get to talk about. This is as the vice president was walking in. This is Doug in the stands.
All right.
Exactly where just 4 months ago the insurrectionists had stormed the Capitol trying to prevent the certification of the results of the election.
So he's blowing kisses and
won the presidency. So I'm just
he's waving like a maniac and blowing kisses at everyone.
And
putting his hand putting his hand on his heart. That's, which is just
I got you, baby.
Jesus.
Me and you.
So
this is just like 15 seconds of a greater whole spiel.
Is he doing that to Kamala?
Yes.
Ugh.
Yes.
Ugh, who believes that? No one.
Oh, and then not to be one-upped, right? The Bidens probably also had a sit-down and a strategy around, okay, well, we need romance. We can't be done up by the vice president. So this is what happened last week when they were boarding.
Yeah. It's Jill and Joe. Joe picks a little flower off the ground, and he gives it to Jill. Oh, that's so sweet. Wow. No. Oh, that's so nice. There's Jill climbing onto the helicopter, Marine One. All right, very good. No, so Joe Biden, please. He picks a flower. Just coincidentally, the flower happens to be, I mean, first of all, he shouldn't be bending over like that. He might crick his back and then he won't be able to go up straight again. But Joe picks a flower up off the ground and gives it to Jill, and then they climb onto Marine One together. It's very sweet. That, you know what, that might be real.
That's gentlemanly.
I don't think it's
no, I think that's not as performance. You think it's all totally put on, Sia? You think it's completely fake? I don't know. Maybe it's contrived. I mean, that's what Yondella's saying. Yondella says it's cringe and contrived. But, okay, so let's assume it's cringe and contrived. It's still a clever, because most people are stupid. I mean, I'm even questioning whether it's real or not. I'm stupid, too, because I think, well, maybe it's possible that he was actually just doing that. Because he saw the flower and he's like, hey, Jill, here we go. Let me tell you, maybe they do have that kind of relationship. We don't know for a fact. Kamala's stupid husband putting on like the biggest performance ever with all those blowing kisses. I mean, come on.
You know what he looks like? He looks like, he, you know, when a whole posse of hip hop guys are at an awards ceremony. Hey, doll. Hey, dog. Me and you. Hey, dog.
Cool. He looks, signs.
Hey, what's good? Peace out. He looks like that. It looks. No, man. You know what? Be who you are, please, man. Be who you are.
All right. Maybe some of it's performance. Maybe some of it's real. We'll never know the truth. But these politicians do play us. And it's time for us to stop taking them at their word. Even if they are doing something good, maybe we should all be as cynical as Sia, huh? What do you think?
But Kamala Harris is a sister, huh? She's black. No, because you know, maybe he's keeping it with the culture. Hey, me and you, girl.
He's trying to look like one of those cool white guys who,
like, hey, babe, I got you, baby girl. I think that's maybe
don't drag me into that one.
I think that's what he's doing. Listen, guys, this thing of we can't talk about color. Please, man, let's have a good time. Let's have a laugh about it. I think he wants to be one with the streets. He's, you know, Kamala's grandmother was probably saying something. Said, "Oh, he's so white. He's so cold." And then he had to. Yeah, no,
those were not gang signs. Those were blowing kisses. He wasn't talking about the Crips and then.
No, but this no, one here.
He comes across this one here as being inauthentic, but he's trying to be authentic.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this one here is like LeBron James to his teammates when someone slam dunks. Like, hey, babe, I got you, girl.
I feel you in my heart.
Aye, man. Aye, that was nonsense.
Speaking of LeBron James, I mean, do you want to talk about the soccer? Because LeBron James is a basketball player, obviously, but we're talking about sport, and that never happens on the show. And when we have Mbolelo or Ben or anyone else who knows about sport on, it's probably a good idea for us to get some, you know, when Simpiwe and Sia and I tried to talk about sport the other day, it was probably the most useless 5 minutes of anyone's life that was listening to the show at that point.
I heard it, and I cried in the shower in the fetal position for 15 minutes.
All right. So let's just talk about this. What happened at Old Trafford? Because I saw it in the news. And I actually, we've got Lucas Radebe on the TV show tomorrow. So
okay.
I was thinking about football, which I normally don't. What happened, dude? Why do all those people storming the pitch?
So it's part of growing frustrations, probably 15 years of the Glazers, famous sort of legacy global family have owned Manchester United. And the European Super League, which was started, was a league where six teams wanted to get out of the Premier League, really, in essence. They would have played, but they would have been part of this elitist league. And it's just building frustration. And yesterday was the culmination of that event to say, right. All right, we've had enough of these people. And when we do it peacefully, you don't listen, is what they say. Although,
what are the fans?
I don't agree.
Are the fans demanding a change in ownership?
In fact, you know what I think is everybody says it's yes. So to answer your question in short, yes.
But I mean, then there's a solution to this in any civilized free market economy. You all club together. It's called crowdfunding, and you buy it from the Glazers. And if you can't afford to buy it, you don't have a say. Sorry.
You know what's not helping is all of their heroes, Gary Neville, Jamie Carragher, and I think it's linked to the current British sentiment, which I think is very troubling for them, but people will have their position. You know, I don't think we should sort of exclude the Brexit sort of sentiment. Britain over the last 15 years has had the sentiment of leave us alone.
You mean this nationalist patriotic
yes,
kind of fervor? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, there is a fervor, and it's been...
Are the Glazers American?
Yes, Americanos. Americans, the Liverpool guys are Americans, and the Arsenal guys are Americans as well. And what they try to do was bring a closed,
and,
what they
and
call
Man,
a collegiate
Man,
style.
Man City is run by, like, what, Saudis or something?
No. It's the Abu Dhabi king, yeah, or the prince of Abu Dhabi, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
UAE.
The royal prince of
All
Abu
right,
Dhabi,
so,
yeah.
So tough titties. I'm sorry, Britain, you don't get to be... Like, if money has flown into your country, if money has come to British football, Premier League football in Britain, because someone wanted to make an investment there and you didn't have rules at the time to limit the amount of foreign ownership of something like a sports team, you can't start moaning and whining now. And if you're not going to buy it back with your own money, you have no say. I can complain all I like about Mbulelo's fitness. I can't own his fitness by coming in and just demanding it and tantruming if I don't get what I want. If I'm not going to do the work in the gym myself, I don't deserve to be fit either.
Just two quick things on this is also the sort of fervor for Britain's changing too fast and blah, 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 Brexit. Is the one thing that they don't realize is there's this idea that there was a golden era of British ownership. Actually, the last time the league was completely British owned, it was disgusting to go there. People of color, women and men, yeah. Families couldn't go to games. We remember the 70s, 80s and 90s, Neanderthals. Then an Australian guy yeah. called Rupert Murdoch brought the billions over the seas and he civilized the lot of them. And now they think, no, I don't care what people say. Those billionaires came and civilized that lot because we know Hillsborough. We know what happened. British teams were banned in the 90s, Gareth, from playing in the European Champions League because they were so thuggish.
You know, you can't. So, also, how many famous footballers, and I'm not including like Gary Neville or any of those people. I'm talking about like world famous football players are playing in the English Premier League, but they don't even speak English. It's certainly not their first language, but they probably can't even speak it as a second or third language. You can't now suddenly change your mind and say, oh, well, those people don't belong here. Sorry, doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
You want good football.
Yeah.
If you want to have the best English Premier League you can have, you've got to take people from all over the world. And if you're suddenly going to apply a national quota system to that, see, that's what I hate about quota systems. It's like always political. Either you've got the best people or you'd have not the best people. There's no in between.
And I just want to finish off on this. You may or may not agree with me, but I know your position on politicians, and I think we share this. There's this idea now what they want to do is they want to involve Boris and some legislation from government. And I said yesterday on the sports
idea.
Show.
What a bad idea.
Thank you. I said, you know what? Anybody, I challenge anybody, even with our beautiful listeners here on Cliff Central, go and find me a time where government got involved, took a little bit of power from you as people, and gave it back. I will wait until Jesus comes back for the third time. Because
it never happens. That once they take power, they never give it back. So, okay, quickly, Bulelo, because we've got a guest coming on in a moment or two who I'm keen to have you meet on the show this morning. But Vasitsana says, I just want to know why Bafana is so shit and there is no hope. Or is there any hope? And they've just appointed Benny McCarthy as the coach, right? Do you care about that? Is that important? Do you think he's going to do a good job?
No, I don't care about this. I'll say this to young people that I talk to getting into industry and work all the time. I don't care how talented you think you are. What you must have in your institution where you're going to work is stability. Bafana Bafana is run worse than a spaza shop. There's no hope.
Oh.
Okay. Then Sergio.
Ben McCarthy has like a theme song ready and waiting for him.
In the 18 area. Halagasha.
All right. How about this from Sergio?
If that is not the song from his first game, I'll be so disappointed.
This is a good question from Sergio. He says there was a huge US company that bought massive stakes in the Sharks rugby team. They have the sports model perfectly worked out. So do you think that's going to help the Sharks? And do you have a problem with a US company investing in any of our sports teams?
I do not. I've said for a long time, rugby is still an amateur game. South Africans don't know how to scale businesses. It's magnificent that the guys come in. Fun tip on that American consortium that came and bought the Sharks. One of the guys who we will have on Cliff Central Sport, which you can catch on YouTube very, very soon, we'll have him as a guest. One of the guys is South African, actually, who's involved in that consortium. Fun fact about him, he actually paid a large portion of Sia Kolisi's schooling when he was at Grey for the scholarship. And that's why there's a big part there. And there are more players to follow to the Sharks, by the way. Great news for South African rugby because we run it like Neanderthals. Great news for rugby worldwide. And Americans are coming on board. If you like the All Blacks, they're going to buy into the All Blacks. There's another consortium. And currently the Springboks, I have it from reliable sources, are in a contractual sort of deal. And at the beginning phases are being bought into by another American consortium. About bloody time. The players need to get paid in rugby. They're criminally underpaid.
Okay.
Great news.
See, I knew we would get we'd get some good stuff out of you this morning, and I'm glad I had a couple of questions for you, and so did our audience. Otherwise, we would have been screwed. Imagine if C and I started talking about sport again; it would be horrible for you.
Oh well, you see, give me the intersection of, you know, current affairs, not even current affairs, pop culture and sports. I'll be able to tell you that. I know it's Rock Nation Sports to the top. That's me, I know.
Rock Nation Sports is Sia Kolisi, not the Sharks. But those guys are involved with Rock Nation, but that's just they're an agency because of Jay-Z. Okay.
That's because of Jay-Z. And let's now manifest Beyoncé playing.
There we go. Fucking Beyoncé. It had to be about Beyoncé, didn't it? You had to bring her in and water the whole thing down.
You hate to hear it.
Okay.
You really do.
You know, it's one thing you want. If you want alpha males to immediately take a complete change of direction, lose interest, just bring Beyoncé up. All right. Let's move on to other things. We do have more to talk about. I'm thinking about this because I've known this guy for a while, and he's been doing these amazing things in movies, and I follow him on Instagram, even though, I mean, I met him before he became a stunt performer. He's really, like, just incredibly talented, and the things that he does. I remember when you were doing, like, parkour, dude, and that was pretty impressive to see, but you're now doing... You have guns, you do martial arts, you fall down from high buildings, you grab onto choppers with one hand. It's just the most phenomenal shit. You got to listen to this. So if you're gearing up for work this morning, imagine what it's like to be a stunt performer. What do you do? How do you prepare? How much do you get hurt? Is it as cool as it looks? We're going to find out because Deville Vanek is with us. He is an actor and a stunt performer, and we thought we'd get him on the show this morning to tell you what it's really like. How are you doing, dude?
Good morning. Morning, Gareth. Morning, guys. Thanks for having me on. It's awesome to be here with you and get to chat about something that I think is not very, very well known. People don't really understand the stunt performer's life and what goes into being a stunt performer.
Well, listen, I remember meeting you years ago. I met you years ago when we were both students in Pretoria, and you weren't doing stunts then, but you could do like incredible shit in a you know, in an urban environment. You were doing this parkour stuff, and you were pretty yeah. impressive at that. But this is a whole different world. I mean, what you're talking about here with stunts is the kind of stuff that we see in the movies. And you are a movie stunt performer. I mean, you've done some pretty big series. We'll talk about those in a little while. But how did it all start for you? How did you get into this?
It all started with parkour. But I think if I can take it even further back than that, I was really blessed with an awesomely adventurous childhood growing up in Pretoria North, and always up in the trees or on the roof of the house. Mm-hmm. Encouraged by parents who kind of got it that, you know, that's what kids are going
to
do.
In other words, your parents weren't saying to you what most parents are like, get off the roof or stop doing dangerous stuff. Your parents said, no, carry on. It's fine.
Pretty much in a nutshell, but, you know, with a bit of common sense, they're like, maybe, just maybe grab your mattress off of your bed uh-huh. and, you know, throw that underneath the tree or yeah. the house before you jump off the roof. You know, things that promote longevity. So that helped. But I was very fortunate that, family encouraged it. I come from a family of gymnasts. So, you know, jumping and flipping and moving around was kind of the order of the day. That definitely helped a lot.
I'm going to just fast forward to the actual stunt stuff, because you've already done, you've stunt doubled for Ethan Hawke, for Guy Pearce, Shah Rukh Khan, Richard Madden. Tell me about that and how you get from being a, you know, a guy who does parkour and jumps off your parents' roof to suddenly being in, you know, A-list movies as a stunt performer. How did that happen?
That was a process over a number of years. Actually, it was parkour and free running that got me my first stunt double opportunity, which was on a movie shot in Johannesburg called Kite with Samuel L. Jackson. It was based on an anime, and the actor that they brought in from Australia, he had to do a lot of parkour and fight scenes in the movie, and yeah, they just happened to know of me. The stunt coordinators happened to know of me because of my parkour background,
right?
And they brought me in. I was at that stage actually living in Los Angeles and teaching parkour and free running there, and just kind of getting involved in the stunt scene in the States. And I came back to South Africa for vacation and got booked on the job at the same time. And that was where everything started off for me. I was on Kite, stunt doubling, mostly parkour and fight stuff. And after that movie, it was done. I was like, this is what I want to do. This is what I was born for.
How many people are there in the world who do stunts? Because it can't be a huge number of people. I mean, it's not as big as acting in general, because there are way more actors than there are people who can do the stunts that you guys do, right?
Right. There's definitely not as large of a stunt performer crowd. Although there is a significant contingent around the world, most countries that I've been to, there are stunt performers. Some of them are just, you know, under the woodwork or not very well known. But there are probably, you know, a good couple of thousand around the world. In South Africa, though, there are a lot fewer stunt performers. We used to be somewhere around the region of about, I'd say 120, 130 stunt performers in South Africa. And I think if anything, we're maybe half of that, even less. Lockdown was pretty brutal and people phased out.
Yeah, of course. I mean, listen, everybody in lockdown was looking for some other gig to keep them in business. But, you know, when you're doing these movies, you don't know. A project could come along where they need you for a year. There could be something that happens that's just, you know, one quick shoot that might take a week or two, but you don't really know how much you could earn. There's no way to plan for that. It's very difficult to go to the bank and get a home loan when you're not sure what your income is. And you've done some pretty big projects. How do you manage that? Because it's not consistent.
No, it's not consistent at all. It's the freelancer's dilemma. That you're working, and when you're not working, you're working on getting work, and that's just the cycle. When you're not on set, you're training to be on set, and then you need to let people know that you are training to be on set and that you're ready, so that the phone rings, but it's also about just being proactive. There are some really phenomenal opportunities in the industry, and unless you are proactive and step out and let people know that you're ready to work, and you'll kind of fade away.
I'm curious about this in-between time, because as you say, you have to be training all the time. You have to be ready to go at the drop of a hat. And I know Mbulelo's got questions on this, because he's a bit of a fanatic when it comes to being as fit as possible, making sure that you're ready for anything. I mean, he runs as if something's chasing him most of the time. What is the fitness regimen, and how do you keep on top of that?
Man, that is an all-encompassing thing, because the fitness that you need as a performer is so multidimensional, multifaceted. You can't just be a good runner. Most of the time, as a stunt performer, your bread and butter performance type of stuff is going to revolve around taking falls, taking bullet hits, doing on-screen fights. So the fitness that you need to have is a lot more about mobility and flexibility and adaptability. So it's really functional as gets. You have to often run and climb and jump over things and pull yourself up onto things wearing weird or bulky costume and pads and things. And it's you really have to be ready for everything. So trying to get through a training session usually takes 2 to 3 hours minimum. And you're working on multiple different skill sets. You're doing stuff between skills-based training and cardiovascular and fitness type of training, because obviously you need the stamina to do this multiple times repetitively, but also the skill to be able to do it exactly the same every time, take after take. So it's not enough to just be able to do a move. You have to be able to do it perfectly
over and over again.
In weird and uncontrolled circumstances. Maybe there are explosions going off, or there's smoke everywhere, or fire, or just chaos in general.
What are the hardest stunts to do? I mean, are the ones where you're in a gunfight harder? Is it more difficult where you have to remember a whole lot of stage cues in terms of like stop, fire, run, do a little somersault or whatever the hell it is, get shot yourself, you fall backwards? Is there a whole lot of complicated scripting and stage direction that goes into these things? Is that the toughest part, or is it actually doing the very hard physical action that you have to do?
No, I think the hardest part is in the preparation. And if the preparation is good, then the stunt itself will go smoothly.
But what is the preparation?
So the preparation, it usually starts with what we call a previs. So where there's a section of action in a script, the stunt coordinator and the fight choreographer will break that action down and take it from words on the page to an actual idea or a concept on its feet. So we'll begin to build out the choreography, and we'll find where the cues are and start to build a story that the audience can follow with the action. And once you begin to put it on its feet and you rehearse all the movements that need to happen, all the cues that need to happen, you start to get a journey that the action's going to follow, and where you need to be at which point in the action, and what you're going to need to do. And then slowly you start adding in things, cues like, oh, at this stage you're going to pick up a gun, and then at that stage you're going to run and jump over this thing, and maybe you get hit midair, maybe you're on a wire. So you figure all of those things out, and then the filming of the previs is essentially like a little mini trailer, a pre-visualization of what the action's going to be. And that's all the prep, and all of that happens before the actual day. So we'll do like a little mock shoot on usually like DSLR cameras to help find the right angles and things. And you give that to the director and the DOP as a bit of a blueprint for the action. And then they bring their expertise to it and
are you with an agency like an actor would be? I mean, do you have to have an agency who can book you for projects, or do you get cast separately as a freelancer? How does it exactly work? And what's the money like? A lot of people might think that stunt performers get paid huge money, and maybe you do. Maybe it's nothing compared to what the actors get.
Yeah, 100% correct. We definitely don't get anything close to what the actors get. It's not a
Which
bad
is so
living.
Wrong. But I'm just going to say, like, that's so screwed up. Here you are doing the most work. I mean, you know, these people come on, they have to remember a couple of lines and pull the right. And you can act as well, by the way. So it's not, I'm not being, you know, unkind to actors on their own, but you can do that as well as do the stunts. Doesn't it feel to you like somehow supply and demand is not exactly the most important metric in Hollywood? I mean, really, you should be paid more if you're doing the dangerous work and you're putting yourself out there and you're getting hurt. And
right. I mean, it's a bit of a frustrating thing because in other countries like the UK, Australia, Canada, America, the stunt performers are very well paid, very well paid. They can do a project for, you know, 3 or 6 months and get, you know, a bit banged up and damaged, but then they can afford to take time out and they can, you know, buy a house, buy a car, sure. make investments, whatever they need to do. Yeah. And then take some time off and let the body recover and heal and then go on to their next job. They can do, you know, 2-3 jobs in a year and be well off, more than fine.
Sure.
But in South Africa, we are earning maybe a tenth of what the international performers, not even actors, just stunt performers would get. When they come here, they come over with SAG-AFTRA contracts and equity contracts and things that are really designed to look after them and not for them to get screwed over.
Have you been hurt really badly?
Production will have to pay big penalties.
Have you ever been hurt really, really badly doing stuff?
Have I haven't been hurt really, really badly. Fortunate, very, very blessed, and I've not picked up major injuries. Lots of bumps and bruises, a broken thing here or there, but nothing crazy. And that's
yeah.
I'm just extremely blessed and grateful. Also, apply common sense. You know, stunts people have this idea that, like Evel Knievel or Hot Rod, like it's just dudes who strap on a helmet and they like stuff it, balls to the wall. Here we go. And actually, it's the opposite. Stunts is mitigating danger. It's taking a dangerous situation and observing it from all angles, doing risk and safety assessments to see where you can control the risk and make it as safe as possible. Inherently, it's still a stunt. It's still dangerous. You're getting set on fire. You're jumping off a building. You're crashing a car, whatever. It's a dangerous thing inherently. But what makes stunts so incredible is that you have a really competent, awesome team around you that help to make things safe. And the whole point of it is to do it as safely as possible. So you, as the performer, you rely a lot on your team. It's not a one-man show. You have to have faith in them that, you know, that the rigging is good, that the setup for the stunt has been made safe, that everyone's aware of what's happening. And in that moment, as the performer, you just click over into a different state of mind. And you just commit, you phase out everything else, and there is just this scenario in front of you. And I suppose you're acting in a way there. The stakes are just a lot higher.
But, well, I just wanted to ask you this. It's Mbulelo here. I just wanted to ask you, as a performer, because I've watched movies with directors before, and it's actually impossible to enjoy it. You as a performer, do you still, when you watch any films, action films, whether big budget or normal, are you still able to enjoy films? Or every time you see an action film, do you now break it down as, because you're an expert in that, do you now break it down? Because I've watched films with, hearing your personality type, I've watched people, films with perfectionists and directors, and it's actually not enjoyable for me. Are you able to enjoy films? Are you able to enjoy films still and just observe them for the art they are on the screen, or do you sometimes find yourself getting too granular?
Blelo, great question. I do have the ability to shut that off and just to enjoy a movie for what it is and get wrapped up in the story. But also if there are some really glaring things, it's hard because you've seen behind the veil.
Yeah.
You know, you're aware of what's going on and what's required, what goes into certain things. So, yeah, sometimes there are moments where it's hard to turn it off because you're going, what are these guys doing? This is ridiculous. Or other times it's just so insanely impressive. You want to know, how did they do that? I have to understand. But yeah, most of the time, if I'm with my buddies, I'll just turn it off. And we all know that guy who sits in the movies and goes, yeah, that's not realistic. That would never happen. That's so annoying.
All right.
I'm not that guy.
Yeah, I'm also a little bit. Hold on a second. Oh, there we go. Sorry, I was on mute.
Yeah,
I'm a bit confused about how they do some of these things, because you on your Instagram you kind of let us in behind the scenes as to how some things get made, but there's so many scenes in movies where I think that has got to be CGI. Do you think CGI is starting to invade the space of what used to be stunt territory? Like, because it's cheaper to just have a bunch of people in a room full of computers make something up on screen and just use, you know, various programs to construct that. And it might even be cheaper than hiring a stunt performer, and it might be less dangerous and they don't have to worry about what could go wrong. Do you think that stuff is starting to make stunt work less and less important in the movie scene?
At this stage, I don't think so yet. I believe that CGI definitely has its place and it can elevate a production. But I also think that at the heart of it, there has to be practical action, because the viewer's eye and the audience is smarter than what we give them credit for. Mm-hmm. And the viewer's eyes are so sharp that you can tell the difference without being highly educated on the subject. You can often tell the difference between what's real and what's CGI, because computer generated stuff just rarely captures the same quality as what a practical stunt does. That's why Mad Max Fury Road was such a massive success. The action was almost entirely practical, and it's a spectacle. It's incredible. And just knowing that as well is like, wow, this wasn't done on a computer somewhere. This was actually people out there doing it for real. So I think CGI has its place. I don't think it's advanced enough yet to where it can entirely replace practical action. And I still think the quality of action at the heart of it. And then
I hate to rush you, and I know that there are probably loads of other questions, and I'm sure Sian Bulelo had a whole bunch of other things they wanted to ask you. But follow the guy on Instagram, and you could see for yourself. It's a pretty impressive selection of action and video and pics of what goes on behind the scenes in these movies, and you know, you with a lot of the actors that you've been the stuntman for. So, dude, I'm just pleased we got to speak to you this morning. It's very cool stuff.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on, guys. I'm always happy to chat about stunts in the industry. I think South Africa is just a phenomenal base of talent, and we're really passionate about creating our own things in South Africa, creating our own quality content, especially action. I know that there's some awesome people who are keen to see South African action, and we can do it on a global scale. We can do it on an incredible level.
There's something it's
about time. Mm. We launched this morning a cool teaser. So check it out.
Right.
Hop on Instagram and check out Black Market Brawl.
There we go. That's your business, thanks. Right? You can also...
operate as Deville Vanek.
Yeah, I'm saying Black Market Brawl is the project you're on at the moment. That's the one you're busy with at the moment.
We shot it during lockdown. Okay. It was a bit of like a love letter to the industry kind of thing. And we just dropped the teaser this morning, and the full project will be releasing within the next week. So we're really excited about that. But
we'll include all the details on the page. But thanks so much, dude. Nice to see you.
Good to see you too. Thanks, guys. Awesome chatting to you this morning. Have a great day.
Cheers, man. Nice. What an interesting job, huh? Imagine that's what you wake up every day to do.
Awesome.
Blow up a car, do a whole bunch of free running, fall down from a great height, get set on fire, get shot with the rubber bullets.
That's awesome.
It's got to be like that is exciting adrenaline stuff, huh? All right, so lots of other things to get to, but we've got to run to Blind History. I almost completely forgot. And today we are talking about a famous woman in history, Cleopatra. This is probably one of the most anticipated episodes. You know, it's hard because history is mostly a male endeavor, certainly from the point of view of battle and destruction and conquest. But Cleopatra was up there with the best of them, and she managed to tame and get so many of the great men of history to do her bidding. What an incredible woman. You want to know more? Then listen to this episode of Blind History. It's brought to you, as always, by Taylor Blinds and Shutters, me and my co-host, Anthony Meterer. And you can listen to the whole thing. If you don't have time now, you can always listen to the podcast later on today. Save it for whenever you're ready to sit down for a good 15, 20 minutes and enjoy a little piece of history that comes to you, courtesy of Taylor Blinds and Shutters and CliffCentral.com. In her glittering palace on the shores of the Mediterranean at Alexandria, Queen Cleopatra, last of her line, could never rest. Her enemies needed to be defeated or converted into allies. No matter the threat from her own brothers or sisters, or even Caesar, Cleopatra used every tool at her disposal to execute her plans. The last pharaoh of Egypt was a cunning, beguiling, and unstoppable force of nature. There's a woman who lived in ancient Egypt. And I probably don't have to say more than that for you to already guess her name. In terms of her reign, she was unbelievably powerful in the ancient world, but she's probably not listed among the greatest pharaohs of Egypt. She happened to live at a time where lots of other famous people, some of whom we've covered in Blind History before, lived. But we know her name, no matter where you come from, no matter who you are. If you can remember just one word, and that word becomes the embodiment of the history of an entire country or the story of one really unbelievably famous person, then I suppose you've done well, you know. Her name is Cleopatra, and I don't know how much you think you know about her, but every single time I find out a new fact about her, I can't believe that all of this happened to one person in one lifetime. Anthony Meterer is my co-host. You're listening to Blind History. We're into season 5 and we're covering a bunch of really exciting people. I know that you're a fan of Cleopatra's, Ant, because in your previous life as Julius Caesar, you had passionate sex with this woman.
Correct. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So I really enjoyed my time and I remember it fondly. Cleopatra the 7th.
That's right. She was the 7th of her name. Her father was Ptolemy the 12th. Her two brothers were Ptolemy the 13th and 14th, but we'll get to them in a second. An interesting family. She wasn't actually Egyptian. She was like all the Ptolemaic pharaohs of Egypt. She was Greek.
I think it's important to look back at that. So during the time of Alexander the Great, one of his close friends and bodyguard and generals, Ptolemy, who became Ptolemy the First, there were some people that said that it could also have been his half-brother, which would be interesting then because Cleopatra would have a direct lineage to Alexander the Great. But upon Alexander's death, his generals divided up his conquests amongst themselves. And after, you know, there was a lot of battles, et cetera, et cetera, Ptolemy settled on the greater area around Egypt and Egypt itself. And that's basically, that started the Ptolemy dynasty. By that stage already, the pharaohs were long gone and Egypt was in turmoil. But yes, so they were actually Macedonian or Greek as we would know them. And they were very, very careful to keep that for the next 300 years. There weren't cross marriages into the Egyptian side and they stayed away from getting too involved in the culture of Egypt until Cleopatra the seventh time.
Well, she was the first pharaoh of the Ptolemaic dynasty to learn Egyptian. She was the first one to speak and write in Egyptian. And there's some interest from that period. She was obviously up against her brother, who was also her husband. And maybe we should talk about that, because you sort of glibly referred to it now, but they actually, incestuous marriages were an important part of the Ptolemaic dynasty.
That's what they did, correct.
Into their own family. So, you know, there's very little doubt that this did addle them down the line. And Cleopatra was, you know, she was forced to marry her brother, first of all, because I suppose it kept them both in power and made a dispute between them less likely. He was 8 years younger than her, or 10 years younger than her?
Correct. And the big thing is they didn't mind killing each other. I mean, the Ptolemies, after Ptolemy the First, if it looked like they were going to get into a bit of trouble, they would just murder, poison their brothers and their sisters. And even Cleopatra, for that matter, that did darken the reputation. She had her brother removed. She had her sister removed. So they really, there was no love lost amongst the family members of the Ptolemies.
Yeah, but they also didn't mind producing heirs with their own family. So that's a whole other thing that we look on these days with horror. So she married
him. But Gareth, maybe that's also something to do with that, the long nose that she had.
Perhaps some other features as well. But she certainly didn't have a lot of love for her siblings. And we'll talk about the sister in a little while. But her elder sister actually ruled before her. And then she and her brother took over. He was 8 years old, I think, when they married. And she was already 18 by that stage. They had a younger sister called Arsinoe or Arsinoe. And really, for Egypt at the time, their biggest concern was being friendly with Rome. They had already had some kind of alliance with the well-known enemy of Caesar, Gnaeus Pompey, who had extracted taxes and food from Egypt. Egypt was important to Rome because they provided grain, bread, and they provided tax money. And Rome was important to Egypt because they provided a military security. And this relationship was difficult, but they managed it more or less. And, you know, Pompey came along. He made some alliances in the right places, and he thought he had things more or less under control. He did realize Cleopatra was a bit of a problem, and she realized that she was likely not to be able to live very much longer unless she got out of there. And she fled to Syria, which was also part of Egypt at one point, and she hid out there for a little while. During this time, Pompey had fought Caesar at Pharsalus. He'd lost that battle, and he went to Egypt to rally his troops and to gather some money so that he could carry on fighting Caesar. Of course, when he landed in Alexandria, Cleopatra's little brother, who was a child, had his head cut off and thought this is a great way to make friends with Caesar. But Caesar didn't like that, did he?
No, not at all. I mean, he was very upset. Look, Pompey was one of his closest friends. And yes, they had a lot of battles in the past, but he was very, very upset. And that backfired on Ptolemy the 13th.
As a curiosity, Caesar was also Pompey's son-in-law at that point. And he was very upset that this Egyptian upstart had decided to murder a Roman general, a Roman consul, no less. And so it backfired badly on Cleopatra's little brother. And so she saw an opportunity because Caesar was furious and they had been in communication. She was much older than her brother, probably a lot wiser than her brother. And she decided, I can win this. Got on a boat, went back to Egypt and met with Caesar. Supposedly she presented herself to him rolled up in a carpet. That's history anyway. I mean, perhaps not factual history, but it's mythology now. And it's hard to tell the difference when you're talking about Cleopatra. And she presented herself in all of her glory to Caesar, who promptly fell in love with her.
Yeah. Also, the love angle and how much Caesar and Mark Antony, for that matter, were in love with Cleopatra is also up for a debate. And it's also very much dependent on whose book you're reading or which research has been done. But there was definitely, she had incredible charm. And I think, you know, Caesar felt he was dealing with an equal, courageous, intelligent, ambitious like he was, witty and beautiful. And then also the big thing is she had youth. And by then Caesar was in his 40s. He'd obviously battled hard and been smacked around in the war. So he really felt close to her. And as you'd mentioned earlier, this was a lady that spoke 10 languages, including Latin, Hebrew, and Syrian. So this was just something amazing that maybe he wasn't used to in Rome.
She took no chances, though. Her brother was found floating in the harbor in Alexandria, dead. Ironically, just as she and Caesar had started their relationship. She and Caesar also obviously had a child, which history seems to gloss over rather a lot. But he was called Caesarion, and he was projected to be pharaoh of Egypt and did co-rule with his mother for a while, but mysteriously disappeared after her death. And we're still not sure whether or not there are any living descendants of Caesar through Caesarion who just honestly disappeared into the sands of time. Some people say he fled into Libya. Some people say he went to live in Rome. There isn't really much evidence of what happened to him afterwards, but we know Caesar had no other legitimate children. So
there wasn't any referral to Caesarion anywhere in his notes or in his readings with the people that picked up his notebooks and diaries. And very little also about Cleopatra, for that matter. You know, he left everything to his nephew, Octavian.
Mm. Well, I mean, at the stage he was assassinated, famously, and we've covered this in a previous episode. Cleopatra is actually living with him in Rome.
Correct, in his villa on the Tiber, yeah.
That's right, and she hightailed it the hell out of there as soon as she got wind of the fact that he'd been murdered, knowing that she was not popular in Rome. You know, she'd brought what they called Oriental, but what were Egyptian qualities and culture to court, which Romans looked down on and considered beneath them. And she thought best to head to Egypt, and she grabbed her son and they fled to Egypt as quickly as they could. Of course, Rome at that point was torn apart because it was civil war, Mark Antony and Octavian against Brutus, and there was Lepidus in the one side, and there was, you know, all the other great Roman families involved in tussles about who would take over. It was a bit chaotic. And of course, Antony and Octavian eventually managed to assert themselves. They had some kind of an alliance. That alliance broke down very quickly. But Antony was put in charge of the eastern provinces. And again, Cleopatra said, I got to get in there. I've got to look after my kingdom. And she went to meet Antony. And she met him apparently very spectacularly. She arrived in a barge, which was covered in silver and gold and gemstones, with cloth of gold around her. People rowing it majestically. You know, if you ever watched the Cleopatra movies with Elizabeth Taylor, the splendor of this woman in procession in these enormous barges, she must have been a real sight to see.
That's exactly what she did. She was an actress, so she knew what to do and how to charm. And Mark Antony fell so easily. He went hook, line, and sinker, and he was a powerful man, and she needed him. Because Gareth, at the time, Egypt was the wealthiest country of the world at the time, and they used to get minerals and agricultural from the West Africa, from India, and they would then spread it to all the countries in the Mediterranean area. So they had a lot of money, that a lot of gold, and she needed to protect that. And what she felt was, with Caesar before he was assassinated, and then with Mark Antony, she was backing the right horse, first and foremost for Egypt, and then also for her family. And a lot of people, you know, don't know that, because she was a very competent queen and pragmatic mother, and very, very anxious to spread the birthright of her children. And then, you know, she was up against one serious propaganda machine with Cicero. He hated her. Cicero was in the Senate, famous lawyer, but he really hated Cleopatra and all she stood for. And Octavia as well, because that was a threat, because the only other living heir to Julius Caesar would have been Caesarion. So they spread this propaganda that she was immoral.
Yeah, it was very much political propaganda and character assassination. And she did have children with Mark Antony as well. It's worth mentioning Alexander Helios, Cleopatra Selene, and Ptolemy Philadelphus. And we don't know what happened to those children either. They're probably all murdered when Octavian eventually conquered Egypt. But I'm jumping ahead, because by the time that we're describing, Octavian and Mark Antony were at loggerheads, and they had the Battle of Actium, from which Mark Antony fled, something people say with, you know, kind of like with a tail between his legs, and went to Egypt and really just sunk into a depression. And they started smoking a lot of opium, and they started indulging in, you know, all the orgies that we read about in history books. I mean, obviously a lot of this is dramatized, because you know how legends come out of truth, and sometimes the truth is just not interesting enough. And people like to portray Cleopatra, particularly if they're fans of Roman history, as being this evil temptress. And whether or not she was responsible or whether Mark Antony just declined after losing at the Battle of Actium, either way, they were in decline. And she had built a mausoleum for herself and for Antony, and they were doubtless in love with each other. And someone said to Antony, Cleopatra's killed herself. And this is almost like a Romeo and Juliet thing, because he took them at their word and fell on his sword, thinking she was dead. She arrived on the scene, saw him dying, and was powerless to help. I don't think he knew that she was still alive, because he'd already died by that stage. But the most tragic love story, if nothing else.
He died in her arms. They carried him to Cleopatra, but he, like you said, he wasn't conscious, and then he did die in her arms.
Apparently she begged Octavian that she might be permitted to mummify him. And when the request was granted, she had herself carried to the tomb and embracing the urn which held his ashes. She famously then was found in her palace by Octavian, who wanted to keep her alive and prevented her from committing suicide, because he wanted to take her to Rome as a trophy.
But she wanted to die on her own terms. I think she lived a life like that. And she never gave, you know, Octavian the upper hand. But she did try at first with Octavian, because, you know, she'd been very successful with Julius Caesar. She'd been extremely successful with Marcus Antony. And she thought, hang on, let me try with Octavian. But she was dealing with a different person. I mean, as strategic as she was, he knew the end game. He was totally cold to her, and none of her charms worked. And when she realized that, she knew she had to commit suicide, because she did not want to be taken in chains to a triumph in Rome.
And she did this by snake poison. Whether or not she brought the snake poison in a basket in a vessel, or whether she actually had an asp, which was a kind of Egyptian snake, bite her, is conjectural. But we do know that she was a dramatic person, and I don't doubt that she would have had a snake slither up her arm and bite her in a last defiant cry against Rome. But definitely one of the most interesting women of the ancient world, and someone who just was at this intersection of history where so many of the great people who were around at that time were familiar with each other and known to each other and spent huge amounts of time with each other, had children with each other. An extraordinary woman by any account, and a great ruler.
100% agreed. And you know, we often talk about Helen of Troy, whose beauty would have launched 1,000 ships. But do we know if she was real? If there's one person that can rival her in beauty, fame, and influence, it was Cleopatra. She was a very real figure. And I think as well, you know, there's often the remark about the length of Cleopatra's nose. I mentioned it a bit earlier. It does an injustice, because although she did attract men, and it was really her charm, her intelligence, her wit, and her learning that brought such great generals, such as Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, under her spell.
Yeah, and if you look at, there is, I think, one portrait they found of her, an actual sculpture of her. She's classically probably not the most beautiful woman, but her legend is so great that we now have this idea that there was this extraordinarily beautiful queen of Egypt. And the whole idea is so exciting and sexy that I suppose maybe here the mythology is greater than the truth.
Probably.
Wow, what a woman. Cleopatra the VII, Philopater. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We still don't know where she and Antony are buried. Hey, their tomb might be hidden in the desert west of Alexandria. There's an Egyptologist called Kathleen Martinez who is digging around the Temple of Taposiris Magna, and she says she may have found their tomb. They have found coins there. They've also found carvings, coins with Cleopatra on them, that show Mark Antony and Cleopatra in an embrace, and they're looking to see if they're, but it seems unlikely that Cleopatra was buried there. And if she is, she'll be buried with Antony. So possibly his ashes, her mummy, in one tomb, that would be a sure sign that you'd found the right thing. CliffCentral.com.